There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, that guy over there, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
Welcome to November.
Yeah, it's a little chillier. It's a little grayer. It's leaves aren't as prominent as they were last month.
But in 19 days, I turned 54. So I've got that going for me.
Yeah, you do.
54. How did that happen? We started this when I think I was 38. And now 54. Mm-hmm. That means this has been a part of my life for parts of three decades. What the deuce?
Mm. 3 decades.
Well, you know, I'm 38. You're in 40s. Now I'm in my 50s. So I'm looking at 30s, 40s, 50s. That kind of weird math thing that comes together.
Yeah. Huh.
3 decades of my life.
Okay.
It's the way I do math, Tim. Don't question me.
I see.
I'm a Rhodes Scholar.
Only because you've been on the road.
Exactly. But the ultimate gift was given to us by one flaming red-haired ginger bastard. He brought them out early, Tim. The McRibs are out. They're so delicious.
Yeah, I know. I mean, what? Evidently, he counts about as well as you do because it was supposed to be November 1st, but the way I see it, I think it was like October 26th, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think he realized that, you know, our needs, they're never going to give us the advertising that we want, but he realized, well, let me just release this about 5-6 days early so that Dave and Tim can partake. So McRib is out there. And folks, again, it's McRib time of year. I don't come to your house and talk to your kids about Santa or the Easter Bunny. Stop writing me about the McRib and telling me that it's made of yoga mat. I don't rain on your parade. Don't rain on mine.
Yeah. Yep.
I like it. Maybe you love Oreos. Oreos, that delicious chocolate cookie with a whipped vegetable and animal fat center.
Yeah. Which is actually made out of cute little baby bunnies. But we don't tell you that.
No, we don't rain on your parade. You go ahead and you eat those Oreos.
Yeah, you enjoy those little baby bunnies, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you go ahead. Yeah.
I had to travel, you know, to go do that cruise, and I had to go in and get a whole bunch of shots and things when I was at the hospital here in this undisclosed location. They were just testing me for a bunch of stuff. And they came back saying that they were kind of surprised. For a guy my size and age, they thought I might be in worse shape than I am, and they were really pleased that I'm not, although they did say the blood chemistry came back, and I am about 65% McRib juice.
Wow.
And about 25% whipped Twinkie fat.
Oh, well, I mean, I would assume that, but I mean, I've known you for a long time, so.
Yeah. So it was just amazing to see that. But, hey, we've got a new month to start here. We've got new stories to share. We've got emails. We've got news. So let's dive into it. Our first news story, Tim, from HuffPost, is a news article that's also a parashare.
Oh.
This person writes about their experiences with the supernatural. My family moved to America and into a real haunted house. Here's what happened.
Hmm.
That's kind of a weird headline.
Well, I take it you're moving from one place of oppression and going into another.
Right. But here's just my thought. What, you know, it needed a flashier, like, family moves to America for safety and finds themselves entrenched in horror. And then you tell your story. But this just seems like, hey, my family moved to America and into a real haunted house. Here's what happened. That's just a weird headline to me. Maybe, I don't know. What happened to the good old days of you know, really like, okay, listen to Bill Curtis even try to make this line important, Tim.
Okay.
My family moved to America and into a real haunted house. Here's what happened.
Yeah.
There's no gravitas to that.
Yeah, it lacks a little punch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Family moves to America to escape oppression and finds themselves entrenched in terror. That's an opening line right
yeah.
there.
Yeah. I think we're what we're missing in today's media is some real creative headlines.
And Bill Curtis reading everything.
Yeah, well, there's
that. I have to apologize. My Bill Curtis is way off. In this undisclosed location, it is wreaking havoc on my vocal cords.
Mm-hmm.
I have to mute myself constantly because I'm clearing my throat like a 98-year-old chain smoker.
Ah.
So, yeah it's one of those kind of things. But let's get started. People didn't want to hear about my phlegmy throat. Here we go. This is the article by Selena Giovanni. As a child, my first brush with a ghost wasn't Casper or some other spook from a children's book. I encountered the real deal in the house that we rented in Pennsylvania after my family emigrated from Kuwait. It was over a century old, essentially the size and strength of a wet shoebox, and was shadowed by an ominous oak tree in a rundown neighborhood. My dad, who grew up poor and lost his father as a teenager, had cultivated a knack for stretching every penny he earned. Years before we moved to the U.S., he squirreled away what he could, which helped him get settled in Pennsylvania when a locally headquartered company offered him a job on an H-1 visa. The timing couldn't have been more off. He left for America when I was just 3, and my mother was pregnant with my brother. But my parents felt that their sacrifices would be well worth the potential opportunities neither of them had been fortunate enough to grow up with. Several months after my dad settled in the U.S., my mom, my brother, who was just 6 months old, and I joined him. We began to hear rumblings around the neighborhood the moment our second-hand, beaten-up Buick crawled up the bumpy road to the curb in front of our new home. The house, the only rental we could afford, I believe is what they were trying to say, was larger than any of the apartment-like flats we'd had in Oman, Cyprus, India, or any of the other places we'd previously brushed dirt. But it was weathered, wizened, and falling apart. At first, my parents chalked up the peering eyes and hushed whispers to neighborhood curiosity. We were new, and my mother didn't know a lick of English. But we soon learned there was something else going on. Even though I was very young at the time, I'll never forget the first encounter we had. One night, sometime after we'd unpacked the last of the few belongings we'd brought with us, I heard my mom calling for me from the living room that connected our rooms on the second floor. When I left my room and found her, she was turned toward the stairs. "I'm here," I whispered. The light snapped on and my mother's face came into focus from the doorway of my room. Her eyes were wide, her mouth agape. Then we heard a loud crash downstairs. An orchestra of metal clattered, and then silence. My mom didn't move. Seeing how scared she was terrified me. Suddenly, she pounded down the stairs. My dad, who had joined us on the landing, was right behind her. My curiosity and my fear for my parents' safety got the best of me. I slinked along the stairs, hovering close to the wall until I got far enough to peek through the rails of the banister into the kitchen. The doors to cabinets and drawers gaped open, silverware scattered everywhere. Pots and pans were strewn about the kitchen floor. My parents scurried to check the drawers and doors and windows and found them all closed and locked. This was not a break-in. And there was no other plausible explanation for what had just happened. Unfortunately, it didn't stop there. It seemed whoever or whatever was living with us was just getting warmed up. We'd leave an object in one room only to stumble across it in another. Pots and pans would clang together in the middle of the night, but when my parents raced downstairs, the kitchen would appear innocently spick and span. My parents were familiar with ghost stories. There was a house in Kuwait where my mom was born that was rumored to be haunted, and no one would go near it at night. My father had his own tales from India. his brother had spoken to an elderly man on a bicycle, only to learn from the neighbors that that man had died years earlier, but still had a reputation for making appearances every now and then. But hearing stories is different than coming face to face with the real thing in your own home. At first, they didn't want to accept that we were dealing with a ghost. We continued to look for any other logical explanations for the activity we were experiencing, but there were none. One day, my mom gathered her confidence and, using her fractured English to string along enough words, asked our neighbor if she knew anything about the history of our home. The woman leaned in conspiratorially and whispered that the previous owner had passed away inside the home. Inside the home, Tim!
Ah!
The house had apparently been her pride and joy, and she'd been particularly obsessed with organizing her kitchen in a very specific way. Now, we were officially spooked. My mom began to pray every night after that. She would extract her rosary beads from a wooden tissue holder, roll out a red rug, and squeeze her eyes shut as she swayed back and forth in deep concentration. The musky scent of incense sticks burning from our kitchen wafted beyond the front door to the street. She believed that no evil would befall a house filled with prayers and praise for God. Because we were poor, moving simply was not an option. And my parents tried to face the situation with as much grace as they could, determined to make the best out of a circumstance we couldn't escape. Slowly, things began to change for our family. My dad worked overtime and traveled more. My mom arranged her schedule around this so that she could take a few jobs from the slim pickings she was qualified for. The unexplained incidents, however, continued. Sometimes a month would pass in between them, sometimes only a few days. Although those years were terrifying, I also learned many lessons that I still hold close to me today. As far as our ghost was concerned, I discovered that if I thought of her as a friendly older woman bustling about her kitchen in an attempt to bake us otherworldly treats, she wasn't nearly as scary as when I imagined her as a witch trying to butcher us all with her favorite knife. Yeah, that's a little bit more unsettling.
Oh, yeah.
That visual perspective that she just painted for us. This exercise in positive thinking didn't always work, though. We were living with an unpredictable supernatural entity, after all. And we never truly felt at risk or being harmed. And I learned that fear is only as powerful as you allow it to be. Dun, 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 dun. That seemed like the more you know moment right there, Tim.
Oh, I thought you were going for Incredible Hulk there. I wasn't
no,
sure.
Okay. No, that's more dun, 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun. I had to do that a couple weeks ago when I got left behind at a filming site. Threw my backpack over my shoulder and threw out the thumb, hoping to catch a ride back to my hotel until they realized that they had left me and then came back for me. But I digressed, Tim. I also learned a lot from observing my parents' courage. My dad taught us to be strong and independent, and he and my mom demonstrated this with the finesse they used to handle everything that came our way. Whether it was moving across the world in their 20s with next to nothing in their pockets and two kids in tow, or living with a ghost. I was also learning about what it meant to be poor and what it meant to be a part of a community. Even though I was very young when we moved to America and therefore had a very limited understanding of the world, I immediately knew it was different from any other place we'd lived. My earliest experiences and memories are piggybacking on my uncle's shoulders after dusk in Kuwait, the sand spreading out before us, the wind tinged with the scent of shawarma, S-H-A-U-R-M-A. Was that shawarma?
S-H-A-U-R-M-A. Shawarma?
Is that shawarma? I've never actually seen the word spelled out, so I don't know. As we trekked to the local street vendor to grab a mango ice cream. In America, we had no family, let alone many people who shared our background or culture. No one wandered the streets past eight, and no music from nearby vendors' carts drifted through the crevices of our windows and doors. Our family struggled financially, but admittedly, what we experienced was different when we had been poor in any other part of the world than we'd previously ventured. Unfortunately, my parents hadn't been so lucky at my age. For them, poverty had meant skipping out on a meal or two, sewing their own clothes, and repeatedly mending the ones that tore. And for my mom, foregoing an education. electricity, water, and gas were considered luxuries, or even just for the wealthy, as outages were common for most people. But for the poor, these fundamentals were often completely non-existent. We were able to survive in America, but without the money to buy anything beyond the necessities. I felt the sting of being an outsider. I was stuck using a beat-up folder with the other girls in my class flaunted their then-popular Lisa Frank school supplies. I envied their vast wardrobes of colorful snow boots, puffy vests, and endless selection of tops. I longed to be able to afford something as silly and indulgent as a slap bracelet or a troll doll or even a trapper keeper. And it is funny what we take for granted in this country, isn't it?
True. Very true.
And that doesn't even mean just for the other people that are coming in. There are people within our own country that can't afford these things.
Mm-hmm.
While I struggled to fit in, the ghost continued to make its presence known. We wanted to leave, but we could barely afford to pay our bills, much less move. As we began to meet our neighbors and they learned about what we were dealing with, they offered whatever support they could. There were very few East Indian families in our area, so many of the people we befriended were curious about our past and our culture. They popped in to check on us, dropped off meals, and left our newspaper, which we subscribed to for the coupons, at the doorstep so it wouldn't get soggy in the rain. But it didn't end there. When our neighbors and my dad's coworkers discovered how much we were grappling with financially, they swept in like angels, donating household items, lending us money, and even once showing up in the middle of the night to drive my baby brother to the hospital when my dad was traveling and my mom didn't have a car. Their actions showed me that humanity can transcend difference and is powerful enough to shatter divisive barriers. These people didn't share our culture or our mother tongue or even many of the same experiences as us. However, they were some of the most beautiful people I'd ever met, and I aspire to be just like them when I grow up. Very nice story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Despite these experiences and our haunted house, my family was still grateful to be a part of this country. My parents' recollections of what circumstances were like in other places they had lived continuously humbled them. No country is perfect, they always told us, but we are lucky to be here. Ghosts, paranormal phenomena. That would kind of suck. You come from another country, you don't have much money, and you move into a place that's crazy, freaky, haunted.
Yep. Frying pan into the fire, so to speak. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Very strange. Yep. All right, let's see. We've got a couple of emails here, Tim. Hey, guys, it's CJ again. I was listening to a video on glitches in the Matrix when I remembered four specific things that happened to me that I still can't explain to this day. Story one, history class. See, I'm trying to make that sound creepy. And it was for me. Although I loved history, I was not keen on our teacher most of the time.
That was one of my favorite subjects.
You know what? I think my problem was is I had like that Ben Stein history teacher for the first 2 years of high school. You know, voodoo economics, right? And just so dry and boring. Then the funny thing is we had a guy from the Czech Republic, Igor Katinsky. I remember his name. He was my teacher for a couple of years for history.
Mm-hmm.
History came alive. This guy loved American history. He was so, it was like Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society. And I thought, isn't it funny that a foreigner with an accent could teach me American history and make it engaging and entertaining. And he, you know what he had? He had this funny, you would have gotten a kick out of him, Tim. He had this picture up in the front of the room. You remember Wooly Willy, that kind of little magnetic pen game where you'd take the filings and make a mustache and beard?
Yep.
He had like that image on his wall. Mm-hmm. And then he had made, you know, put a full like masquerade beard on it.
Okay.
And if you said something stupid or he busted you not paying attention, you had to go to the front of the class and stroke Zeke. So you'd have to pet his beard. And there was a little wire in there that would light up his eyes. And so when you'd pet him, his eyes would, so he'd be like, all right, get up. Time to pet Zeke. It was just a way to engage you again. And it made people laugh and kind of got people re-engaged in the moment. The guy was great. Igor Katinsky. He was one of the good teachers I had growing up.
I think I would have rather had him than Mr. Dahl. Mr. Dahl was a good teacher, but he, when you fell asleep in Mr. Dahl's class, now mind you, I had him for history and then honors history. He did one good thing at the end of the spring semester going into summer, and I'll tell you about that in a second. But the all year round, he would say, "Don't ever fall asleep in my class or I have a big surprise for you." And we were like, "Oh, a big surprise. Well, that can't be bad, can it?" Right? But what the big surprise was is, you remember the thin yellow wiffle ball bats?
Oh, yeah.
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 Well, what he would do is he would walk around and he would wait for you to fall asleep, and then he would slam it on the corner of the desk right near your head.
Oh, geez.
And it would go wham, and he'd jump up and he'd go, "Welcome back to the class."
Whew.
Yeah. You know, that
I'd rather stroke Zeke, to be honest.
Yeah, I would rather stroke Zeke too. Now, the last couple of days of honors history were, you know, like just kind of blow off days or whatever. And he said, "Now, if you guys and gals think you're having any type of fun with me, or going to play pranks with me, or think you're bringing squirt guns in or whatever," because, you know, there were rumors that seniors were going to bring in squirt guns or whatever. He said, "If you think you're going to have any type of fun with me like that, you're not. If you're going to go out and buy expensive squirt guns, they're going to be mine and I'm going to bring them home to my kids. And if you think I'm joking about that, I'm not. So don't invest in the water gun technology, because it's going to be my kids." You know, and he said, "You can take one shot at me. You can have your little fun. You can."
Jesus, was this guy like a former Vietnam vet? He was really. That's just a weird thing to focus on.
I don't know, but you know, here me and my friends going, "Hey, at least we get one shot at him, right?"
Oh, jeez.
So I went out and I got one of those. At the time, keep in mind, I'm dating myself here, but it's 1988, and they had the little battery operated. Machine guns, the water machine guns.
Sure. Where
if you put the battery clip in, it would go vew, 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 and it would shoot. It looked like a country mile, but I could hit Mr. Doll from the back of the room. So
you were one of those rich kids with the automated machine gun.
Oh, no, no. I was working at Chuck E. Cheese, my friend, every night after school. So I had the money to go out and get one of those machine guns. So I snuck it in. And in the second to the last day, because it was like 3 days before the end of the year, second to the last day, I pulled it out right before the movie. And I forget what movie he was showing us, but it was one that, you know, is kind of questionable whether you show it to seniors or not. So I pulled it out right before he's about to load the movie into the VCR. Yes, VCR. And I stood up and I had the machine gun in my hand and I said, "Say hello to my little friend." And I hit him with it and the entire class started laughing and I soaked him. And he said, "Mr. Dennis, my kids are going to love that." And he just put his hand out and I just handed it over to him.
Wow. And he let you get away with that one shot.
Yep. That one shot.
Because the payment was, you shoot me, I get to keep your gun.
That's it. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So he was a cool teacher. That was probably one of the coolest teachers I ever had. Yeah. Besides my journalism teacher, my newspaper teacher.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Well, CJ, I promise I'm going to get back to your email here. Are you ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
Story one, history class. Every day in this class, we take notes for each chapter that our teacher was affectionately called JJ put up on the projector. I got ready to write notes when I noticed the pages he put up were already written in my notebook. I asked the girl next to me if he could have put the wrong notes up and showed her my notebook. How did I already have that day's notes in my notebook? I was told they were new and we hadn't yet taken this chapter. Da-da-da-da-da. That is weird.
Yeah.
The next story, Tim, is called Tinkerbell. It's hard to make that one sound evil.
Yeah.
I have this memory of a Disney video of Tinkerbell coming out at the beginning of a video trying to bring up the Disney logo, but her wand wouldn't work, so she tapped it on her hand and then it worked. According to Disney, this doesn't exist. I remember that. I do remember that because she like, bing, and nothing happens, and then she shakes a little bit, gives it a rap, and then it comes up. I remember that as well. So we must be from the same parallel universe. Welcome, brother or sister. It's a CJ. I don't know which one it is. The man in black. I was living in Texas for college. I had a dream at the dorm that I had gotten on the city bus to go to the college and that a man in black business suit and hat got on the bus. I was scared and panicked waking up. I figured I was stressed and then just laughed it off. But then I got on the bus And one stop later, the man in black from my nightmare got on the bus. Let's just say I noped off that bus pretty quickly. Nope, 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 nope. What makes him scary? Because he was dressed nicely and wore a fedora?
I guess.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that an elite racist? I don't know. What do you call that? Somebody that's like, oh, I'm offended. You're well-dressed and a hat.
That would be an elitist. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The three men on another bus. I was again on the bus, but this was back home in my city. These three older men got on the bus. They looked a lot alike and sat one row behind each other almost robotically. Then after sitting, all three men turned their heads again robotically and looked back toward me all at the same time and turned right back to face forward. Yep, I got off that bus pretty quickly as well. What the heck's going on out there? CJ, I'll be honest with you. It sounds like alien abduction stuff to me. I mean, not the Tinkerbell part, because I remember that. But if you're seeing a man in black with the hat, and then you're seeing these three robotic, I wonder if it's some form of alien abduction. Hmm, something to consider. Or maybe not.
I don't know. I don't know. I've never had three people come up at the same time and turn their head and look at me, so I don't know.
Okay, this next one asks us to please withhold the name.
Okay.
And although I'm billed first, I don't know if I should be offended in the fact that I'm just good old Dave and you're Mr. Dennis. I love your show and would like to say thank you. Your show is a very important resource for those listeners looking for answers that no one else can provide. I would like to begin with a few things that I had noticed about the History Channel's The Secret of Skinwalker Ranch. I have to say that I've really enjoyed their show also, but they've seemed to have left out some explanations of a few things. First, it seems like they've not even mentioned a very real possibility that there might actually be an ancient nuclear reactor underneath the area. In Aklo, Gabon, on the west coast of Africa, scientists had discovered a natural fission reactor that had taken place about 1.7 million years ago, and that it was very well could have run for hundreds of thousands of years, producing over 100 kilowatts of power, thermal power. Okay, this is not fantastically written. I'll do my best. There had been accounts of strange lights in the area dating back through history from the local inhabitants about strange lights coming out from under the ground. I know that this explanation is only one possible answer to some of the phenomena that they have there at the ranch. It would also explain some of the other strangeness. For example, Caleb Bench, his cell phone acting weird. Nuclear fission can produce a multitude of gamma rays. Gamma rays have been shown to affect the microchip transistors in electronic equipment. So basically anything that has a microprocessor can be affected. I was made aware of this from a wonderful episode of that podcast Radio Lab produced back in May of 2019. It was a very interesting episode about something similar. Second, there's also another reason that a nuclear reactor is a possible culprit. Roughly 300 miles away in Colorado Plateau in Utah is located America's first uranium mine. So that would state that there is a very high likelihood of there being radioactive elements in the area. Third, when the area has thunderstorms move through the area, activity usually ramps up, which actually could be a result of water becoming neutron moderator for radioactive elements buried in sandy levels underground, causing the reactor to go critical and start producing energy. Fourth, because of the very strong magnetic field in the area, most likely the result of a meteor that fell in the area, the ionizing radiation that had been detected in that area might actually be traveling along the field, creating radio signals. YouTube science educator Anton Petrov has a very good episode about something similar having been detected before by scientists, especially around Jupiter and its magnetic field. Fifth, the laser experiment that baffled everyone at the ranch. Well, that one is very interesting. See, the laser definitely showed a type of refraction that usually occurs when light passes through a type of material that is transparent and reflective, like glass or plastic. So what invisible object could there have been between the origin of the laser beam and the mesa it was being shined onto? It was definitely not a reflection for something on that surface of the mesa. The action of how the beam was moving and how it was split was pointing to refraction, not reflection. So what unseen thing was it? That I don't know. Sixth, Thomas Winterton seems to have been attracted in the very same way the many different people throughout the world had fallen victim to something called Havana syndrome. Havana una na. There you go, Tim. Which is also attributed to being assaulted by direct microwave radiation. Oh, and a bit of a side note. I've seen a couple of shows lately that have brought up Robert Bigelow and his UFO artifacts discovery in Brazil. On the TV show Contact, 2019 season one final episode, they brought up some kind of document regarding Operation Plate. They used their link analysis software and were looking at the document from the 1970s. At 2 minutes and 56 seconds, another very notable name also appears, Hal Puthoff, along with Mr. Bigelow. Also, if you go to the YouTube and watch Third Eye Spies, at 1 hour, 54 minutes, and 28 seconds, Hal Puthoff is actually credited for retrieving alien artifacts. I seriously would love to ask Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ if they've ever spent any time at the Skinwalker Ranch. Obviously, Hal and Mr. Bigelow have worked together in the past. Even though I provided a lot of different explanations for much of the phenomena, it doesn't explain it all. Keep up the good work, and that comes from the Gingerbread Man. Interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know what I make of the Skinwalker Ranch. I mean, obviously it's a fascinating place, but I just don't know what I make of it. I don't know. It's crazy. Well, Tim, it's time now to meet Scary Mary, the UK's most haunted doll. That's right. A man who owns a haunted museum in England maintains that one of his exhibits is very much the real deal. And we've got an audio daily double for that right now.
Kicking off at our This Morning Mansion today, but we're not the only building in the country experiencing some strange goings-on.
A haunted museum in Stoke-on-Trent is claiming to be the proud owner of the UK's most haunted doll, known as Scary Mary.
She sounds
Scary
nice.
Scary Mary. As well as a host of other possessed artefacts. Owner Craig Longson joins us now to explain. Good morning.
Good morning,
look
Craig.
Look at that. That's very...
Glad you're down
good morning,
the line,
everybody,
Craig.
Wow. So, this was your grandfather that started you off down this path, wasn't it?
It is indeed. Many years ago, when I was about 10 years old, shortly after my grandfather had passed, we actually felt his energy around. I could smell his tobacco smoke from his pipe. I was, only a young boy, and it's kind of, at that age, hard to understand your experience at that point. So I was kind of intrigued from a very early age within the paranormal industry.
And also your home when you were growing up was haunted, so you were used to seeing spirits and ghosts around.
Yeah, it was the house that we lived in was very, very active. It was quite a large house. It had a couple of big landings downstairs, a big old cellar. My dad, particularly as well, in the middle of the night, he would randomly see him. If he got up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, he would be sitting on the end of his bed. He would proclaim to be talking to his auntie, who passed many years ago as well. So there was a lot of strange circumstances in that house that kind of always had you thinking of what else is around with you at the time.
So the blue touch paper by then has already been lit, and you get into your 20s and decide to go with a bunch of mates and check out haunted locations.
Yeah, there was three of us. We just sort of got together and we were having a chat about things, as you do, different times of the year and, experiences that we'd had. And the three of us just sort of started going around to the UK to different locations and seeing what we could pick up on, experience for ourselves within the industry, and it kind of escalated from there then.
Well,
so,
thanks.
Yeah, we went to some fantastic places.
Some of them got a bit scared. Some of them stopped. You didn't. You then started your own paranormal events company, which is taking you to many, many strange and wonderful places. What's the weirdest, scariest supernatural thing you've ever experienced?
I think for me personally, it was about 2015. We went to Mill Street Barracks in Ellesmere Port. And myself, and there was 20 other guests on this event, and it was for an external events company. So I was the guest medium on the night. And we saw a lady there that was, the only words I could kind of use is she seemed as if she was possessed by something. And it was witnessed by everybody on that night. She even comes onto our page now. She interacts with members of the public and tells them in her own words what happened as well to herself and her experiences with that. So it was a pretty scary thing to witness in front of yourself. You see these things on movies, TV, but when you're actually there to experience somebody who's been overtaken by something, it's quite scary, yeah.
Well, you've set up your company, Ghost. What does Ghost stand for?
It's Ghost Hunters of Stoke-on-Trent. So it's run by myself, and I have five amazing team members, which is Justine, Gemma, Lucy, Sam and Caroline. And the girls, they all donate their time for us, the volunteers here at the museum, and the very experienced investigators, and they love doing what we do. So, you know, we have got a good experienced team behind us.
So let's have a look at some of the things, because you're currently in your haunted museum, and this is something you set up in lockdown. All these artefacts were in your home. Are you completely bonkers? But now they're all in here. So show us what you've got, because we definitely need to meet Mary.
Okay. Yes, definitely. Well, this is Mary. This is, we class Mary as the most haunted doll in the United Kingdom at the moment. She's an amazing doll. She dates back to around the age of 1951. So she's got a great age to her. We sort of adopted Mary in the middle of last year. So we've had her for just over a year now. And as soon as we had her, she started being quite active in our room. She's been seen many times on CCTV where she's actually the chair spanned from side to side. The chair's rocked, her eyes have moved, she's thrown herself out of a chair on two different occasions. She lights up lights that are around her, the equipment sometimes that she likes to play with. We've had four members of the public on a tour here, and she was actually on the table in the centre of the room and she was rocking in front of them. Another three ladies who came on, they were having a tour and they actually witnessed her eyes moving all the way over to the right and recentered themselves as well. Yeah. So
did that
it's
not
incredible
just scare the living
have,
daylights out of you? Like, did that just make you go, I want to get rid of her?
No, not at all. She's amazing. She's a great artifact, one of the best that we've ever come across in all my years of doing this. So sometimes it can feel a little bit untowards, but most of the time, yeah, we're quite comfortable with Mary's energy that's around.
Oh my God.
What else have you got?
Okay, so we'll take you a little look around. There's a lot of artifacts that come through. A couple of the main features that we like to look at is the coffin. This was donated to us again last year by a local lady. And originally this came from her pub, which was a haunted pub as well here in Stoke-on-Trent. And it was donated by a local undertaker who had had it in storage for years and years. And this was actually used in the World War to bring fallen soldiers' bodies back into the United Kingdom. There's over 1,000 bodies that have been documented to have been in that coffin. So that can be very, very active. We get a lot of bangs, scratches, knocks around the coffin. People who stand by it get icy cold at different points. It's a piece of history and a great artifact to own for to do with the paranormal research that we do as well.
Wow, have you got
and
a pram?
And then over here, pardon?
The pram. Have you got a scary pram?
The pram, yes, we have indeed, yes, down here at the front. So this Victorian pram, I've had this in my possession for about 10 years now. On many, many live feeds caught on camera that this pram has been seen to be moved forwards and backwards of its own accord. And we've had this going on for about 8 or 9 times over the last year. And it, like I say, it doesn't just roll one way, it rolls backwards and forwards. So it moves in both directions. And it's a great piece to have. It's always put in front of the coffin. The room as it's set up here, the corners, originally how this was all produced in my house and where we used to work. So all this was in my home through lockdown. The other artifacts that we would like to show you is what we class as the poltergeist mirror. This comes from our local house in Audley. And two families owned this mirror, and it was their aunt who got in touch with us. She was kind of distressed that the homeowners were seeing a little girl in the mirror to start with in the bottom left-hand corner. There was a gentleman very recently here at the museum who proclaims to have seen the same girl in the mirror, and also a shadow man in the mirror of a 3-year-old boy of the second nephew's home. We had to go and remove the mirror and do a cleansing of the house and take it away because of the activity that it was creating in there. Things being moved around, doors being slammed, people being touched and things
Craig,
like that. Yeah, so
yes. Are you actually open to the public?
We are indeed, yes. We do daily tours, guided tours here, where people can come around, see our artifacts for themselves. What we want to do is give people a real experience of our museum, and these are real artifacts.
Holly will be
with
there.
Documented history.
She'll be there like a shot. I suspect you'll be hearing from her today,
yes,
I would have thought. Yeah.
Miss Scarlett won't be there.
Yeah, I would have thought.
Thank you, Craig. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks, mate.
Thank you.
Brilliant.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Angie. All the best.
Bye
all
now.
The best. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
And Tim, that's the story of Scary Mary.
I suspect Holly will be there like a shot.
Like a shot? Do you have a haunted pram? That's a baby buggy. What the hell, a haunted baby buggy?
I guess, yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. But Scary Mary sounds freaky. Throwing herself out of a chair, Tim. Sometimes the chair swivels.
You got to get out somehow.
Scary Mary.
Yeah.
We have another story of another haunted doll, Tim. And for those of you that are interested in seeing these videos, photographs, and more, go check out darknessradio.com. Click on the news tab, and you'll find all the information there. A husband and wife team of paranormal investigators claim their Annabelle Raggedy Ann doll is possessed after it attacked one of them and overturned their Ouija table, Tim.
Uh-oh.
Lee and Lindsay Steer, who run the Museum of Haunted Objects from their home in Rotherham, South Yorkshire, says their Annabelle Scary Mary doll is an identical copy of a notoriously evil rag doll in the USA that inspired the Conjuring horror films and has left them scared for the first time. Now, Lee, 36, and Lindsay, 52, who both investigate supernatural happenings full-time, fear further reprisals from the toy, which they believe has also caused them to narrowly miss crashing when it has been in the car. Lindsay, who says their fascination with the supernatural hastened their romance when she and Lee met online 5 years ago. What we saw the other night when she threw the Ouija table or spirit board was pretty scary. It was on October 24th, which was the 2-year anniversary of us getting her. She's from the same factory and is a twin, if you like, of the real Annabelle that inspired the evil doll in the movie The Conjuring. Now, kept in a museum for the occult, the American Annabelle doll gained notoriety in the 1970s after being bought as a child's toy when it's claimed that it started to attack people. We didn't know our Annabelle was possessed when she first came into our life, said Lindsay. She was given to us by a fan who thought that she was just a replica of the American Annabelle doll. We had no idea that she also was haunted. She added, but there's no denying that there's something powerful about her. Lindsay, who first saw a ghost 25 years ago when she was alone one day at the dressmaker's where she worked and saw a curly-haired woman like Coronation Street's Vera Duckworth, Tim. I know you're a big fan of Coronation Street.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And you still have that Vera Duckworth painting on your wall, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I treasure that. Yeah.
Yeah. It was amazing to me that you pulled down the Farrah Fawcett poster to put that up.
Well, you know, I mean, times change. And every once in a while, we got to put Farrah to the side and put Vera up. I mean, yeah.
Well, she saw this ghost walk through a closed door and fears Annabelle may wish them harm. She said, even when I saw my first ghost at the dressmaker's, I felt calm rather than frightened. I'd grown up watching all sorts about aliens and ghosts, so I always was interested in the paranormal rather than being frightened by it. But some of Annabelle's actions scare me. Our Annabelle was made in exactly the same factory as the American one, so she's like her twin. Lindsay blames two near misses while driving with Annabelle in the car on the doll, as well as a mysterious illness. She said, I had two near crashes when Annabelle was in the car with me in October of 2019, just after she arrived. In the first one, a white van nearly went into the side of the car, and I was forced to veer off the road. In the other, I was on a roundabout. I'd sort of pulled out, and then another car pulled out pretty quickly in front of me. She added, then my mouth became full of abscesses and I became strangely ill. I was just having these awful pains in my stomach. I couldn't keep anything down and I even went to the hospital for test after test, but they couldn't find out what was wrong. Then on October 24th, the second anniversary of them acquiring this Annabelle knockoff, Lindsay swears the raging rag doll struck again. The museum, which the couple who married on Halloween 2019 started back in March of 2018, after being inundated with paranormal curios by some of the 2 million fans who follow their paranormal activities on Facebook, is also home to Elizabeth, reputedly the world's most possessed doll. Fearing Annabelle is jealous of the attention that Elizabeth attracts, Lindsay said, on the second anniversary of getting her, I was watching Celebrity Coach Trip. I wanted to see it as Elizabeth was on it, and I suddenly felt a pain in my right arm, like a burning sensation. She added, I looked down, and my arm was bleeding. I couldn't believe it, but I instantly knew it was Annabelle. I do wonder if she was jealous. Later that night, the heavy metal Ouija table used for seances to contact spirits was hurled over. We have a Ouija table for visitors to use, said Lindsay. She added, Annabelle was sat in the room staring at it, and it just flipped over all of a sudden and fell on the floor. It was in the middle of a visitor seance, and they rang us. So we looked at CCTV and couldn't believe our eyes. It was definitely Annabelle forcing the table over, as no one touched it. I mean, it's solid metal. There's no way it could just flip over on its own. She added, when we got in the next day to survey the damage, it was clear something paranormal had happened. The metal was bent out of shape and the base had come free from the fixings. There was no way this was an accident or coinkydink, Tim. No coinkydink here.
Nope.
And this was not the first time the couple believe Annabelle has used the heavy table to convey her anger. Lindsay said, "We were doing a Ouija when Annabelle first arrived. Basically, spirits communicate with you, and we were sat with Annabelle when a voice came through saying, 'I'm going to kill you.' We never got the museum blessed or anything like that, as it's always felt safe, but we now think this has something to do with Annabelle." She added, "At the moment, though, I think her anger definitely stems from jealousy of Elizabeth. When my arm was burned, I think it was her saying we should do more with her and get her out more. I think we definitely need to give her a dust and some attention now." Lee, whose interest in the supernatural was awakened at age 20, when a variety of objects in his home mysteriously flew off shelves and odd hand and footprints appeared on his window, agrees that they need to placate their angry doll. Not usually one to react emotionally to the unexplained, he is very scientific about their paranormal investigations, using equipment, Tim, to detect electromagnetic fields, because bananas don't cut it anymore. Thermodynamic monitors to check for strange heat sources and radio devices to help with communication. But Annabelle has left even this seasoned ghost hunter feeling unnerved. He said, "I felt a little nervous going back into that museum. It's dangerous what's happened. It's made us all very uneasy. I showed some friends the footage and they couldn't believe that she'd bent the metal like jelly." Does one bend jelly, Tim?
I've tried many times, Dave, to bend it around the bread, and it's pretty hard. Yeah.
Yeah. "I think we'll put Annabelle in her own case to make things safer." You copycats. Just because it was made, you know how many millions of Raggedy Ann dolls have been made? Does that mean each one is possessed? I think not. I think not. But what do I know? Let's take a quick break. When we come back, a scientist has invented technology to see a multidimensional being, Tim, and a famous movie horror house is on sale. We'll talk more about that when we return to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program. Thank you very much for contacting me by email, sharing your stories, your thoughts, your input on our show. We appreciate it. And Tim, with that said, I wanted to jump to a quick email following up on last week's point when I talked about the term slaves versus enslaved people. Okay. We got an interesting email. "Hey, Dave and Tim, I'm listening to episode 125 News and Parishare, and you and Tim took a pause for the cause and started talking about the change between slave and enslaved people. I'm not a scholar, but I've been black for 50 years. So here's my thoughts on the change. Slaves was and is seen as property, therefore not seen as people. Although they had lives, families, knowledge, history, and shared love and pain like any other race of people, including the whites that own them. The key word in enslaved people is people. Because we're entering a phase in society where a lot of harmful and historic wrongs are being rectified and corrected, the enslaved people that helped build the economy, fought in its wars, and helped create this nation are finally being noticed as not just property, but as human beings. You said yourself that enslaved people makes it sound more dramatic than it truly was. That may be, but we can't discount the fact that it was not only dramatic, but traumatic. In a lot of cases, still dealing with the trauma to this day. Case in point, white people are still flying the Confederate flag. So how are we supposed to feel about the vestige of slavery being displayed today? Things change and wrongs need to be corrected, even in America. Anyway, I love the show, especially News and Parishare. The story about meeting and getting the shout out from the member of Striper was pretty awesome, bro. Keep up the great stuff you're doing. Be safe and take care. And that comes from Ramsey. Ramsey, thank you for writing in and sharing that. That makes all the sense. You're right. The key word is people. Slaves is a generic kind of broad stroke of ownership of property, enslaved people retains their humanity and shows you that these weren't just objects that we own, but that they were people. And that's a great input on that. So thank you so much for listening to the show and for writing that very insightful piece in. We appreciate it.
And as we get, I guess, further and further away in the annals of time, it's easier to gloss over a lot of things.
Right.
And it seems like, I mean, even when we, and I hate to even think about this, Dave, when we look at like World War II, you look at the fact that we have Holocaust deniers. I mean, you know, stuff like that. I mean, it's just sad that we can't stay humanized when it comes to atrocities in every single act in history. So.
Yeah, you're right. Fascinating. We do need to learn from our past and adjust. Thank you so much for giving us that very interesting insight. Daniel Nemes, scientist and inventor, originally from Spain but residing in Colombia since he was 14 years old, became interested in astronomy and science. He was a member of the Astronomical Group of Madrid, Spain. He says that the project that he's been working on started when he read an article in a magazine about the dark matter of the universe, and the multidimensional universe momentarily interested him and called attention, so he had the initiative to perform mathematical calculations and optical experiments to be able to capture images of the beyond. Now, this news story does have a video, and you'll be able to go watch that on our site. Go to darknessradio.com, click on the news tab. You'll find all these news stories there, and you can watch the video as well. He discovered a method of capturing far superior to infrared, ultraviolet, blacklight video camera with TV without antenna, etc. And that method I called Energvision. I use special lenses, ultra-sensitive screens of this invention, and above all, sunlight. I feel like this story might have been poorly translated from Spanish. I could be wrong. The images that he captures are of unknown origin. He explains that his theory is that they are images of other planes. However, he says he has not traveled to other places to expose the invention. He has tried to make known to the scientific community and only answered a scientific body of the USA and in a rude way. See, I think some of the translation is lost here, but the media have ignored and silenced the discovery along with the images that he's captured. This article includes many of those images, Tim. Now, Daniel Nemes says, the only way I have to publicize my invention and the captures are by Facebook. Since 2015, I've posted 1,000 photos on my Facebook. When I started to publish my images on my social network, I had a lot of rejection. It was very hard, and even insults were hurled at me. Fortunately, my images are now more known, and when I post on Facebook or in other groups, it is rare to receive a disqualification or insult. But you can be a judge for yourself looking at the images. There are some wacky-ass images on this thing. I'm just flitting through them. I mean, there's some just bizarre shots he's got, some almost demonic-looking creatures. Some of these creatures look, I don't mean to be dismissive, but they look like they're straight out of He-Man.
Really?
Just like this one has got like this super muscular body with almost like a lion head and like a chest plate armor, it almost looks like. Just weird, weird pictures. This, I would love to work with this guy. There's like a giant Mothra looking being. This is really cool. Then there's this image of, looks like a gray sitting in a yoga position. It's very cool. Wow, I'm just flipping through these. These are pretty impressive, man. If you want more information about his technology, you can go to a link that's in the article as well, Daniel Nemes link. So go check it out for yourself. I'd love for you guys to weigh in. What do you think of these photographs? I'm gonna click this over real quick, Tim, and send it to you because I want you to just glance at these photos and see what I'm talking about. But my God, if he's figured a way how to photograph this stuff, that could be huge. Huge. Do you hear me? Huge.
Huge.
Yeah. I'm going to send this over to Bill Chappell. I'm going to tell him maybe you can contact this fella. I'm spelling everything incorrectly, too, so he'll enjoy that.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll be all over that. Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah, Maysby, I said.
Maysby. Instead
of maybe. Yeah, Maysby.
Oh, he'll love that.
Maysby, you can contract this fella. and Ekchan, I forgot the E, Ekchan Ideas. But yeah,
he'll fix it. First thing he'll do is call you and ask if you're feeling okay.
Yeah. And, yeah, it's like I'm suffering a stroke or something. Yeah, have you ever gotten a strange text out of the blue from somebody you love and it's like just wackadoodle writing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's a couple of those I've gotten, and I contact the person, and they were like, oh, I'm on Ambien, man. I'm sorry. I was probably night texting. Night texting.
I love that song, by the way, by R.E.M. I don't know. Yeah, yeah. It's a great song.
Are you looking at those photographs?
I am, yeah, yeah.
They're pretty impressive. Those are cool and weird looking.
They're very bizarre. I'll give them that.
Which is what I used to put on all of my dating apps. I'm cool and weird looking.
Yeah, well, it explains a lot. Yeah.
All right, bitch, you want a new house? I got your house. The Nightmare on Elm Street house is on sale. How about that, Tim?
It can stay there.
No, if settling down for a good night's sleep inside a house once haunted by the razor-tipped fingered demon known as Freddy Krueger sounds like you're kind of fun, here's one hell of an opportunity. The house featured in the original Nightmare on Elm Street, it's on sale, Tim. How much do you think that the house that really was only used, you know, for the exterior shots, I believe, how much do you think that house is worth? And just so we can clarify, it wasn't really haunted by a razor-tipped fingered demon known as Freddy Krueger. That was a movie.
What state are we in? What market?
Let's see. North Genesee Avenue, the iconic location, is in LA's Spalding Square neighborhood. The address was 1428 Elm Street in Wes Craven's 1984 horror classic, but the property is actually located on North Genesee Avenue. I think on that same street, if I remember, our good friend Dre Fordham took me for a little like cool tour driving around LA. She took me down the street, and I think it's on the same house as the house from the three houses they used in the original Halloween.
Okay, I'm going to go 1.5.
Okay, now let me give you this information. The Dutch colonial style house built in 1919 has three bedrooms, three and a half bathrooms, and of course, the pool that Freddy Krueger is enjoying in the photograph above. If you find yourselves genuinely spooked by the home's link to the movie, fear not. According to the LA Times interview with the realtors representing the property, the ties to the movie stop as soon as you walk through the front door. Inside, it's a beautiful traditional style space with a modern twist. Welcome to Elm Street, bitch. The Nightmare on Elm Street house is homey, pleasant place if you forget about the movie association. The new owners will look out their picture windows each day to see terraces and patios, as well as nicely landscaped yards with citrus trees. There's also a guest home on the property that sports a designer bathroom,
guest
kitchen,
home.
And patio.
Okay, you didn't mention guest home. 2.5.
So unless you're worried Freddie might be coming for you as the kids sing in the movie, just be sure to get your offer ready, Tim.
Okay.
So what do you think they're asking for? You say 2.5, knowing 2. Everything you know now, 2.5 is where you're going.
Yeah, 2.5. Yeah.
$3.5 million.
Boy, that's an inflated market if it's 3.5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Crazy. Even if I had 3.5, would I buy a three-bedroom house with three? How come there's three and a half bathrooms in a three-bedroom house?
Does each
room get its own shitter?
Yeah, pretty much.
Shitter's full, Clark.
That was very eloquent how you put that.
Thank you.
Each room gets its own shitter.
That's right.
Yeah, it's
and down next to the kitchen's another.
Yeah, you gotta have one next to the kitchen in case we had got a bad meal.
Crazy.
Three and a half.
All right, so that's for sale. There's go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna say three and a half. So there's a shower in case there's a nuclear blast.
I guess.
Yeah.
I'm not. But they have a nice pool and a guest house out back, so that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Now, in filming the amazing TV show The Holzer Files, which is a paranormal themed show, don't be fooled by the name. We're not just a spinoff of The Rockford Files. The Holzer Files, which we filmed for two seasons, one of my favorite places was a location called the Morris Jumel Mansion. And I love this place because of the original ghost story attached to it. This isn't just legend. This actually appeared through multiple newspapers. a group of children on like a field trip had gone there. They got there early with some of the parents and teachers, and they were creating a ruckus in the front yard when a woman came out on the little veranda and hushed them, then went back inside. And then a few minutes later, the docent came to let them in, and the teachers apologized for the loudness of the children and didn't mean to bother the person inside. And she informed them, there is nobody inside. I'm the first one here. And she says, no, it was one of the reenactors. She came out on the deck and hushed us. And again, she said, there's no one else here. When she let them in, there's a large portrait of Mrs. Jumel hanging on the wall. Sarah Jumel, I believe is her name. And everybody recognized her as the woman that came out and hushed them. That's what drew Hans Holzer into the case. He investigated. We investigated. Amazing place. Well, the Morris Jumel Mansion is back in the news, and we've got another audio daily double for that. Let's go ahead and give a listen.
The Morris Jumel Mansion was completed in 1765 as a summer house for Roger Morris, his wife Mary Phillips, and their family on approximately 135 acres of land. With the outbreak of the American Revolutionary War in 1776, the Morris family abandoned their summer home. Museum coordinator Meg Lynch takes News 12 inside on an exclusive paranormal tour. As we made our way through the first floor of the mansion, Meg recalls a weird encounter reported by a colleague.
One of my colleagues who actually spearheaded our paranormal program was vacuuming in here. Now these carpets were woven on 19th century looms, hand woven, so they are very delicate and need to be cared for. So he was vacuuming, left the room, turned the vacuum off, left the room, and a short time later heard the vacuum turn back on in here. Yeah. That's probably the biggest event that's occurred in here.
She says that's not the only one. As we made our way to the second floor, she begins to detail another chilling encounter.
Often we smell the strong sense of body odor as we're going down the stairs, and strong smells or scents are believed to be one of the ways in which those in the spirit world might be able to communicate with us. I always say investigate with your five senses. What are you hearing? What are you seeing? What are you smelling? What are you feeling in your gut?
What happened next? Direct communication with spirit.
So right now we're going into Washington's war room, and we're getting a ton of activity, you guys.
On both of our meters.
On both of our meters.
And it stopped immediately at the same time too.
Oh, I literally have chills.
Oh, the cat balls just went off.
No way.
Yep.
Both?
No, just this one on the right. So if you just,
So the cat balls
were good. Yeah. So if we saw the light go off, if you could do that again, just so that we know it's you, we would really appreciate that.
Oh, whoa. My meter just went off. If there's anyone here, could you touch the cat balls on the fireplace? I think there's someone here.
Can you please touch that ball again?
It's going off here.
Can you please touch the ball on the mantle?
It's definitely going off. Right in this area.
Let's see if I get the same reading.
Yeah. Oh, and then it goes away. Yeah. If there's anyone here, could you touch the cat ball? So go off if you...
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, can you touch it again just so that we're sure that that was you?
Moments later, after voicing and asking whatever we communicated with not to follow us home, our camera battery died.
Lee, what happened?
The battery died
completely, so now we have to change our battery, and also our lights went off.
They started blinking. The lights started blinking, and then they went off
completely.
Completely.
And now they can't turn back on.
The question is, will you visit?
The Morris Jamal Mansion, Eli Murillo, News 12. Oh, and happy Halloween.
First of all, why do they have to keep, you know, poking at the cat's balls to get...
Yeah.
That seemed weird.
Well, I mean, you get a more positive response when you poke at them as opposed to caressing them.
What cat balls are, kids, are these little light-up balls. They're like a clear plastic light-up ball that has a button. When you touch it, it turns it on. So anytime the cat bats it, it flickers and lights up. But you do have to touch it pretty hard to get it to interact. So by putting them out on mantles and on the floor in an area where somebody, you know, could play with the balls, that's when you start to see this type of activity. And actually where we were filming recently, we've used those tools, you know, as a possible way to confirm paranormal activity. And we've had some really interesting results with it. So they're just these little light up cat balls, that they're toys for cats, folks, not testicles of cats, just so we're all clear on that. But interesting, again, the video, all that information up on our website. Here, Tim, are six paranormal legends said to come true every November. Now that Halloween is past, it doesn't mean the reports of ghostly goings-on become any less frequent. Halloween is past, and the paranormal database details the often sinister histories behind the reported hauntings. Here's a selection of six spooky legends that could be coming true over the next 4 weeks in the UK, Tim. The Headless Saint in Halstock, Dorset. The headless ghost of Saint Jithwara, known locally as Jithwere, is said to appear and walk towards the local church every November 1st at 1 a.m. The 6th century martyr was beheaded by her own stepbrother after his mother tricked him into thinking she was pregnant. Another female spirit reputedly haunts the Quiet Woman Inn in the center of the village. There's also the Jumping Lady. Constantina Hare's specter can be heard screaming every November 3rd as she reenacts her final seconds, according to legend. The Lady Coraline died in 1680 after jumping from a balcony at Bruce Castle, understood to be a deliberate act to escape the possessive nature of her husband. Witnesses also report once seeing a group of gliding spirits in 18th century dress partying at the site on the same day, back in 1971. Then, of course, Tim, there's the Devil's Stone. And this is in Shaber Devon. These names are so fake. Following a long-standing tradition, villagers congregate each November 5th to turn over a large stone that stands by an oak tree. It is said that if they fail to do so, disaster will strike the region. According to one story, the last time locals forgot was just before the Second World War. Now, some believe that the devil is trapped under the boulder, which gives the name to the village's pub, the Devil's Stone Inn. So I don't understand it. So you flip the rock on top of him every couple of years just to keep him contained? I don't get it.
Sure.
Sure. Yeah. Then there's Harold's Army in Horley, Surrey. Weird. As midnight on November 11th approaches, it is said that a phantom bell begins to toll near the medieval site of Thunderfield Castle. See, now that's a kick-ass name for a castle. We're going to go invade Thunderfield Castle. I wouldn't think that's a good idea because it's called Thunderfield. That sounds dangerous. See, that would be something that would spook me off if I was a warrior.
Well, I mean, it's only thunder. If it were Lightning Field, that would probably keep me away.
The area is believed to have been a resting place for the army of Harold II as they marched towards Hastings in 1066. The spirits of soldiers reputedly pass through the site at exactly 12 a.m. on this day every year. Then there's the Hospital Nun, the location Stanmore, Greater London. A gray lady appears every November 13th at the Royal National Orthopedic Hospital, according to local legend. The building was constructed 115 years ago on the site of a former nunnery, which is thought to provide the origin of the story. It is suspected that the ghost was once a member of the nunnery's sisterhood. And then, Tim, there is the phantom coachman of Lee, Worcestershire. Worcestershire.
Sure, yeah.
A phantom coachman is said to ride through the village on November 24th, drawn by four fire-breathing horses. It is thought that the specter, known as Old Coles, used the River Thames to cool his animals. Legend says that it is the spirit of local landowner Edmund Coles, who once fell into debt and attempted to rob a friend on horseback. That's pretty creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool little places to visit. Ghosts that appear on time, like they do a stage show every year at that same time. It never actually happens for me when I go to places that claim that, you know, on the 3rd of March every year, the ghost of Elvis walks in and, you know, orders a donut. It never happens.
Yeah, funny how that doesn't quite turn up the way it's supposed to.
Our next story, Tim, takes us to one of our favorite places in the world. Dun, 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 da, da, dun, dun, da, 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 da. Springfield. And here are some of the stories behind some of the legendary hauntings in Springfield, Illinois. Retired Springfield High School art teacher Cindy Huffman described Rachel, a ghost who has been around the school for the past four decades, as part of who we are. She's more of a mascot, said Huffman, who had several run-ins with the child ghost before retiring 4 years ago. There wasn't anything to be scared of with her, so many times you hear of hauntings that seem demonic, and it was absolutely nothing like that. She's very mischievous. She was a kid. She was not mean. She just wanted to be acknowledged. Rachel is one of many ghosts said to be haunting the Springfield area, from the Illinois Governor's Mansion to the Legacy Theater. There's no shortage in finding those who want to introduce you to ghosts in the area. Garrett Moffat's Traveler's Rest Tours features the Dead Walk, a haunted history tour of Springfield, a Springfield ghost hunt experience, and specialty walks exploring legends surrounding the creepiest of all presidents, Tim, Abraham Lincoln.
Really? That's the creepiest?
I don't know. No. Just trying to help them with marketing. No. Springfield Haunting Tours offers separate walks in Springfield, Jackson, and Carlinville. So that's one way. Moffitt said those who take part in his ghost hunt experience will get a history of each building along with any ghost hunting equipment. Then the Springfield High School. Huffman was among a group of faculty members and employees at SHSS. Talking like I worry about texting on Ambien. Okay. Huffman was among a group of faculty members and employees at SHS who would regularly eat lunch in the boiler room within earshot of a tombstone connected to Rachel. The tombstone was uncovered by workers installing an elevator shaft at the school in 1983. The school is built on the site of the former Hutchinson Cemetery, which was closed by city ordinance in 1874. Most of the bodies were exhumed and moved over to Oak Ridge Cemetery. The tombstone is marked Our Daughter, and on top, cut down but not destroyed. On the front, a definitive identification hadn't been made as to who the marker commemorates. Huffman said retired custodian Daryl Hicks came up with the name Rachel for the ghost. Huffman even did a drawing of the little girl described as 10 to 12 years old based on Hicks' description. The drawing hung on the bulletin board for about a week before it just disappeared, disassembled. Huffman discovered in a binder belonging to Hicks. I guess ghosts don't like their image, Huffman said. Rachel would often open the elevator door for the custodians. Huffman said, though she recalled two school district carpenters who refused to ride the elevator. They would put their tools in the elevator, hit the button for the floor, and then walk up, she said. Other workers refused to go into the boiler room because that's where Rachel hung out when she wasn't in school. The SHS Student Film Club, guided by advisor Dave Heinzel, made a documentary about Rachel back in 2009. Like Huffman, Jeff Lightfoot, a history teacher at SHS for the last 23 years, appeared in that documentary. Lightfoot said he hasn't had any direct encounters with Rachel, except for hearing random noises in supposedly empty classrooms and having the occasional elevator door open for him on its own. I love the story about the history of Hutchinson Cemetery and the plot of land SHS is on, Lightfoot said. Rachel is definitely a fabric of the history of SHS and is one of the most unique things about it. Then there's the Illinois College, Tim. Professor of History Jenny Barker Devine said ghost stories permeate the Jacksonville campus, founded in 1829 and the second oldest college in the state. Barker Devine also said it's important to set the stories in context of the history of the buildings and to tell the real stories behind the ghost stories. So she leads Haunted Hilltop tours on campus at 6 p.m. on Thursdays, Tim. So in case you're there and looking, yeah. It formerly belonged to David A. Smith, an attorney and friend of Abraham Lincoln. The legend is that his daughter Effie had a beau who was killed during the Civil War. On receipt of the news, she flung herself from a rocker at the top of the house and died. A story persists that if the rocker is moved, Effie will move it back. Barker Devine said, other unexplained events include clomping footsteps, temperature changes, and doors slamming. In reality, Effie Smith married and moved to Cairo, Illinois, but who has time for logic, Tim? Another sister, Emma, died at the Jacksonville State Hospital for the insane, although the place is refuted, in 1887 after 9 days of acute mania, according to her death record. The ghost stories, Baker Devine said, only started circulating around the 1980s. Barker Devine insisted on telling the stories of both sisters. What really stood out about that story was that somehow we can accept this romantic story of this young woman falling to her death because her boyfriend was killed. But it's a lot harder to talk about a woman struggling with a very real mental illness. Another ghost is said to haunt McGaw Fine's Art Center. The figure, Barker Devine said, is widely known as Frederick Frank Hayden, a former dean of the college. The man is seen in the wings of the theater wearing a suit from the 20s or 30s. Hayden said several newspapers reported that he died while attending an IC football game in 1922. So why does Hayden show up at the theater? Barker Devine said the college's athletic fields once stood where McGaw was built in the 1970s on the campus northwest edge. I tell people if they see him to let him know football moved down the hill to the new field. She's a card, Tim. Most of the goings-on at the governor's mansion have been attributed to Catherine Yates, the wife of Governor Richard Yates, who ran it from 1861 to 1865. Smoke alarms are known to go off for no reason, and on one occasion, an Illinois state trooper was trapped in an elevator for hours, Tim. Catherine Yates' son, Richard Yates II, would also serve as Illinois governor from 1901 to 1905. Then we have the Legacy Theater. Author Troy Taylor, a friend of our show, says of the Legacy Theater, formerly home to the Springfield Theater Guild, there's a very good chance this is the most haunted building in Springfield. Taylor noted unexplained sounds and lights have been heard and seen. Sets and prop pieces have moved and fallen without human invention, and the pungent aroma of a certain facial cream that occasionally lingers. A lot of fingers historically have been pointed to Joan Neville. The story was that he was set to play a leading role in a 1955 show when it was discovered that he had been embezzling money from his firm. Just days before opening night, Neville committed suicide, and since then, the strange activity has commenced. Then there's the Eldred House. Shortly after this 23-room mansion in Greene County was completed in 1861, the 4-year-old daughter of traveling salesman James J. Eldred died in that home. Two other daughters of Eldred would also die in the home of disease, and Eldred himself purportedly died there. Volunteers working to restore the home reported hearing voices and whispers, or have been touched and tapped on the shoulder, and tools ending up in other places. American Hauntings has recently hosted ghost hunts and investigations of the home. So there you have it. Those are some haunted places in Springfield, Tim. So if you ever find yourself bored and lounging about in Springfield, boom, there you have it.
Well, there I go.
Here's six paranormal legends. Oh, we already read that one. I don't need to cover that one again, Tim. I like that story so much, I put it in twice.
Well, there you
How about this one? Ghost hunter suffers a paranormal hangover after angry specter whooshes through him at a haunted Victorian fort. Tony Ferguson is the specter detector that we're talking about. A ghost hunter described his atrocious paranormal hangover caused by an angry specter that whooshed through him after telling him to get out and chasing him down the corridor of a Victorian fort 2 weeks before Halloween. Personal trainer Tony Ferguson, 36, visited Fort Whitley near Portsmouth, Hampshire, a reportedly haunted building used in both World Wars, with his financier wife, Beverly, 46, and a group of ghost enthusiasts. Fluffering Fluckatash. They're looking for paranormal activity. He ventured into the coal tunnels beneath the building, aiming to confront the spirits alone. Tony of Lyndhurst, Hampshire, said, "I called out to the ghosts. Anyone need help? Are you lost? Are you trapped? Why are you so angry?" This is often what I call out to get a response from spirits. In reply, I repeatedly heard, "Get out, leave. Say it, don't spray it." I heard both a man and a woman's voice. They really didn't want anybody there. Then suddenly, at the end of the tunnel, I saw a mass of fog shooting down towards me. It lit up. I started to retreat, running back down the tunnel, managing somehow to turn around while I was still filming. Tony had taken an infrared camera with him and captured the whole astonishing episode on film. Then I felt a whoosh when the spirit went past and I could feel it go straight through me. Afterwards, I felt completely drained for the next few days. It was a paranormal hangover. But this isn't the first time that Tony has caught a ghostly apparition on film. Back in 2016, he made headlines after capturing the outline of a man skulking along the corridor and moving through a wall on camera at the Bodmin Jail in Cornwall. You can see a figure that looks sort of old world with his head down, walking across the bottom of the cells, basically just going towards nowhere, preferring not to research a location before his visits. So he has no prejudice or expectation of what to find. Tony will later discover that his extraordinary film had been shot on the anniversary of the death of William Hampton, who was hanged at the jail on July 20th, 1909. They believe that this was the last walk he did before he was hanged, as he was the last man to be hanged at the Bodmin Jail. Being a magnet for ghosts has had its uses for Tony, who said it helped clinch the relationship with Beverly, who has also had a long-term interest in all things paranormal. When we first got together, ghost hunting was already a big passion of mine, so I took her to events and she noticed the amount of paranormal activity that happens around me, he said. I suffer from ADHD and have higher energy levels than most. I think that helps spirits to manifest around me more easily. Since as early as he can remember, Tony has experienced spooky sightings in broad daylight in his grandmother's London kitchen when he was just 3 years old. Tony started meeting a ghost. When I went over to my nan's house, I used to cry a lot, and she thought it was because I didn't like her. She was wrong. It was because I would see this gentleman in the house, a tall figure wearing a suit. Another well-dressed ghost. That's terrifying. He looked like someone from the 1900s, and we reckon now it's my granddad's dad. It used to happen often when I was left alone. My grandmother would go off and do something, and then the figure would appear. He would walk into the room, and I would start crying as I was scared. My grandmother would just come back into the room and ask, "Why are you crying? Why don't you like it here?" But it wasn't her fault. It was the ghost. He recalls another ghostly encounter when he stayed over at his childhood home on the eve of his grandfather's funeral back in 2005. "I woke up, looked up, and saw the silhouettes of an old woman in a white dress in her 70s sitting at the end of my bed looking at me. She then walked off and went straight through the wall. When after some time passed, he mentioned the apparition to some neighbors. They showed him a photo of a woman who had passed away in the house, and it was her. It was the night of my grandfather's funeral. She must have come to check up on me," he said. "She was known as the lady who loved the children by the neighborhood, and she died in the room I was staying in. Now happy to make the most of his gift, Tony and his wife enjoy conducting spooky investigations together. They look for ghosts in abandoned buildings and attend special happenings like the one at Fort Widely run by Ghost to Ghost, a team who hosts paranormal events. Something of a dab hand at catching spirits on camera, Tony is keen to add to his spectral video library." So there you have it, Tim.
Hmm.
Good old Tony and his paranormal hangover.
Yep.
Wonder how long it's going to take for Zach Galifianakis to jump on that and make a new paranormal hangover movie.
Oh, I'd say about 4 or 5 weeks.
We have some bad news to report, Tim.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. It's a real horror story. A woman shot dead after dressing as a ghost to scare her neighbors is a prank that's gone horribly wrong. A woman was reportedly shot dead after her prank, dressing as a ghost to spook her neighbors. The unidentified victim, said to be aged between 20 and 25 years old, was roaming the streets in Nacaplan de Juarez, Mexico. I know I butchered it. I'm sorry, my Spanish-speaking friends. She was wearing a white gown and a veil. She donned the scary getup in a bid to frighten residents in the neighborhood of San Miguel Doram on October 15th. The woman had dressed up as the weeping woman known as La Llorona. In Latin America, a ghost who is said to walk the streets mourning her dead children. According to folklore, the terrifying figure walks the earth in despair after drowning her two children in a river in a fit of rage after seeing her husband with another woman. Locals said that they saw the ghostly woman prowling the area on October 15th while shouting, "Ayo, mis hijos." I don't know how to say that. I hope I got close. "Ay, mis hijos," meaning, "Oh, my children," of course, Tim, in case my translation did not come through properly.
Yes, yeah.
One resident filmed the woman's antics just moments before she was reportedly shot dead with several bullets by a scared neighbor. According to local reports, the spooked shooter fled after opening fire on the woman. The municipal police have not revealed the victim's identity, and no arrests have been reported in connection with the shooting. State authorities have reportedly launched an investigation into the shocking incident. It comes as thousands gear up for Day of the Dead celebrations across Mexico on Halloween. The video of the weeping woman has since been shared across social media, as well as gruesome images allegedly showing the victim. Children are often told the terrifying tale in a bid to encourage them not to wander off in the dark. Why, if you think it's the ghost, why would you shoot at it? I'm going to prove that ain't the ghost. Boom, boom, boom.
Because if it's the ghost, it'll be safe. If it's not the ghost, you got him.
Good Lord.
I don't know.
How sad is that? All right, here's an interesting topic I don't think we've ever covered. The evil eye in the Mediterranean. How to avert accidental envy. The ancient Mediterranean belief of the evil eye still has its adherents today. Those who have the eye are thought to give bad luck unintentionally to anything or anyone that they are envious of. The evil eye is an accidental kind of misfortune, and anyone might be capable of casting it. Simply congratulating someone or admiring a neighbor's belonging is thought to cause a calamity to occur if not accompanied by a blessing. This belief is very different to curses, which require a witch or sorcerer to make the magic happen. When it comes to the evil eye, Tim, anyone can possess it, and no special skills are required. Historically, the varied ways in which we could be cast, prevented, and cured make up a mind-boggling landscape which is difficult to navigate. Just as amulets are used in many cultures as lucky charms or for religious protection, they have traditionally been just one of the array of tools used to combat the ever-present risk of the evil eye. When Cliff was born, his grandmother, Vicky's mom, pinned a red piece of string on him, a red piece of yarn.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what's that for? She goes, to avert the evil eye.
Hmm.
And she was dead serious. Polish person.
Yep.
That was her belief system. And I'm like, well, what's the evil eye? She goes, if people give that kind of side eye, like, that's casting the evil eye. Anytime you kind of look at something and feel jealous or gluttonous or envious of it, and you're kind of casting that look or disapproving, you're actually casting kind of this superstitious curse on a person. The person would use different rituals and symbols depending on where they wanted to prevent the evil eye or if they need to cure its effects. They might put horns on their house to absorb the evil eye cast by someone walking by, preventing it from affecting them, or they could make the sign of the horn with their hand to deflect the evil eye as soon as it had been cast. So I guess when you're throwing out the old devil horns like you would at a rock concert.
Yeah.
You're just bang, bang, shooting that power back at Metallica. Bang, bang. Enter Sandman, kiss my ass. Bang, bang. Right? You're just firing them back at stage. There are also numerous ceremonies carried out to cure the evil eye once it had been taken hold. Almost anything was thought to be vulnerable to the effects of the evil eye. A person, their spouse, their children, or livestock could fall physically sick or suffer with mental health because of it. Farmland might become less fertile. A household object might break, or a terrible accident could befall a family member. Farmland might become less fertile. Would you mind if I stood up, pulled my pants down, and you just shot a dirty look at my balls, Tim, just so, you know, maybe I'll be less fertile?
Oh, not at all. Go ahead. Sure.
All right. Here you go.
Yeah.
Oh, Tim, that was evil. I felt that.
Oh,
ooh.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully I'm less fertile now. Sometimes a person could just simply face a long period of bad luck, which seems to come from nowhere. So how do you identify who casts the evil eye? The reason a person regularly gave a blessing after complimenting someone was because everyone thought they might possess the evil eye. It was therefore important to make a statement to prevent its ill effects, just in case. Oh, Tim, I really like that new shirt you're wearing. May God bless you and keep you. So see, that way you're counteracting it by sending good love to them as well, I guess.
Yeah.
Envy was viewed as something that anyone could feel on some level, so no one could avoid accidentally becoming a caster. In some communities, the evil eye was thought to be inherited and permanent, but mostly it was seen as a temporary problem. Sometimes a caster who was thought to have certain characteristics that made them more likely to fall into this envious trap. Those who behaved in antisocial ways, showed too much interest in their neighbors or had an unusual lifestyle were thought to be particularly susceptible. Identifying the caster didn't constitute a witch hunt or bad treatment of the person in question. Rather, it was a blameless sort of mission to resolve the issue at hand. The caster would often agree to give up a sample of their clothing for the ritual to cure the afflicted. Ultimately, depending on the religious beliefs of the culture, the eye was thought to be caused by evil spirits or something similar. The emotion of envy invoked those supernatural entities who temporarily imbued the caster with a power they did not choose to have. Now, since reproductivity was important to families, children were seen as particularly at risk from the evil eye, especially newborns. Just like I told you, my ex-mother-in-law pinned that red strand on Cliff's onesie. They believed that curing the evil eye was possible, but it was much more desirable to stop it from taking effect in the first place. Hiding from people was really the only way to totally avoid the effects of the evil eye. This was practically impossible, even in the most rural of societies. Therefore, other measures were needed. Mothers-to-be often hid their pregnancy and labor until the last possible moment to avoid attracting any envious glances or comments. Once their children were born, it was common to refer to them as stupid or make alternate negative comments to deter envious thoughts. Oh, so see, Tim, all that abuse of, you're so dumb. God, why are you so unattractive? Wasn't a way to hurt you. It was a way to protect you.
Uh-huh.
Only we knew.
Right.
In some cases, they also dressed them badly, rubbed dirt on their faces, or gave them unflattering nicknames. Hey, barf breath, come here. Let's go to the circus there, shithead. So, right, if you've got a bad name, they're all like, oh, who's going to give him the evil eye, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then people look down upon things that they don't like, so wouldn't that be casting an evil eye as well? Oh, shithead. I don't want to know that kid, right?
Yeah.
There's no winning in this case. Strangely enough, vulgar profanities were sometimes used to counteract the evil eye. Well, that I'm good at, Tim. I think I just proved that, right? So if next time you give me an evil eye and I shoot you the devil horns and then go, no, fuck you, you'll understand what's going on.
I guess.
Yeah. As previously mentioned, if a person were to compliment someone, like, for example, by saying they love their glossy hair, glossy hair, it was customary for them to follow with an immediate blessing. If they didn't do this, there was a possibility of being afflicted with the evil eye energy. Luckily, it was believed that a widow of opportunity existed. Oh, I'm sorry, a window, not a widow. Words is hard.
Yeah.
Luckily, it was believed that a window of opportunity existed during which the envied person could deflect the evil eye energy floating around the other, preparing to make its attack. Certainly, swear words said discreetly were believed to diminish its powers. Son of a bitch. In Balta, for example, there are a few amusing examples, such as the Gahank Fashma, which means stick your eyes up your backside. And if you don't like that one, Tim, you could always do the Gahank Gafanghank, which means your eye in my eye. The second eye meaning, yes, you guessed it, the rear end. In fact, there are reports from many cultures where genitalia are referred to loudly or more discreetly as a way of deflecting the evil eye. My balls! There you go, Tim. I just deflected the evil eye for both of us. It's a weird, weird story. Now, you can cure the evil eye, Tim. It says, and there's a video in this news story from Beyond Science, Curse of the Evil Eye, and it teaches you about this so you can go through it. History is full of stories about curses, witches, and magic. Traditionally, a person who thought that they had been cursed was keen to understand not only who was the cause, but also how they enlisted someone to help them out. A specialist was almost always needed for such magic to be effective. Removing the curse was also a complicated procedure fusing pagan and religious practices. Some witches were cast out of society for the role that they played, while others ended up in much worse trouble. Denunciation was very much a part of the process. In the world of the evil eye, a person might cast it accidentally and without blame, but a specialist was also needed to cure it. Herbs, oil, water, burnt leaves, prayer, and religious chants were all combined to create ritualistic cures for those believed themselves to be afflicted by the evil eye. I'm going to do a little cure for you here, Tim. Are you ready?
Ready.
Kumalara, kumalara, kumalara vista. No, 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 la vista. Ini mini ex mini ua la wala mini ex mini zala mini ua la wala. It piddly oat and boat and bobo bedeaten hatten. You're clear, Tim.
Ooh, ee, ooh, ah, ah, ting, yeah. Ting, walla, walla, bing, bang.
Be careful. That's a totally different thing, Tim.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In the world of an evil eye, people might cast it out accidentally without blame, but a specialist was needed. Diagnostics were also carried out using oil and water to be sure that people that were affected by it worked to cast it out. These so-called specialists fused together pagan and religious belief systems to produce a familiar and trusted ceremony, and often the caster was included in the cure. It was socially acceptable to politely request the caster for help since they hadn't caused the problem intentionally. Although many different parts of the Mediterranean were referred to in this article and the belief system has varied over time, each individual community still had a complex and bewildering set of rituals related to one problem and in some cases still do. It's customary to assume a rural Mediterranean society in the past were relatively simple, but there were, in fact, complicated places where the evil eye coexisted with beliefs in witchcraft and religion, creating a rich cultural environment. In general, anthropologists view the evil eye in a similar way to other magical practices. In times of uncertainty, when survival was often dependent on uncontrollable elements such as weather, beliefs and rituals helped people to explain and manage their environment. Infrequent but difficult occurrences such as drought, infertility, or diseased livestock needed an explanation beyond that of chance. So basically, it was just a way to try to, you know, it can't be that I just have shit land. Somebody gave me the evil eye. They were just kind of lumping it all together on that.
I see.
Very strange. Well, that full story and video is up on our site at darknessradio.com under the news tab. Finally, Tim, FedEx pilots filmed a UFO that followed their plane. A cargo plane reportedly encountered a mysterious object during a routine flight over Mexico. According to reports, the incident, which took place on March 19th, involved two pilots who had been flying near Monterrey when they encountered a pulsating orb. The unidentified object dropped down from above and matched their altitude before flying alongside the plane for around 30 minutes. While the pilots have not been named, one was understood to be a career pilot with over 19 years experience, while the second was a veteran fighter pilot who previously had flown F-15s. They have been described as competent airmen, highly experienced with observing and identifying aircraft, and are capable of determining normal observations and incidents from unusual ones. According to the report of the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, also known as NARCAP, why do we need to put it into that form? The plane had departed Querétaro International Airport when the sighting occurred, Tim. The first officer had initially believed the object to be a meteor, until it matched the plane's speed and altitude, indicating that it was under some sort of intelligent control. The captain described the UFO as a brilliant, bright, yellow, white plasma object in a teardrop shape. The two men actually managed to capture around 5 minutes of footage of the object, which also features their dialogue at the time of the sighting. NARCAP Executive Director Ted Rowe found the incident particularly intriguing. "We have a database going back to 1916, he said. It describes four basic types of UAP encounters. That's unidentified aerial phenomena. And that's right. And they're balls of lights, spheres, cylinders, and disks. I went through the analysis. There was some argument that it could have just been an astronomical effect. Venus was quite bright that night. But when you take the entire narrative of how they described it, dropped in vertically, stopped at their altitude, and then paced their aircraft, that is a very consistent story with UFOs. We've heard many of those. They flew northbound out of Querétaro Airport. Venus was quite high in the western sky at that point and bright, and they were well aware of it." And guess what, Tim? If you go to darknessradio.com and click on the news tab, you can find this article, and they give you a link to the actual footage of the UFO that was captured.
Huh.
So yeah, I make it easy as I can for people to follow up on these stories, Tim. They just have to go to darknessradio.com, click on that news tab. While you're there, also check out our shop. You can get a lot of cool paranormal swag for the holidays coming up, or maybe some of your favorite true crime books we've covered on True Crime Tuesday. So there you go.
There you go.
Well, that's it for today, kids. Thanks for tuning in and spending your time here on the best in paranormal podcasting. I'm Dave. That's Tim. This is Darkness Radio.